In the CV's small print were interesting assignments in the secret world. Kissinger not only had a doctorate in his back pocket, but a bulletproof security clearance that proved to be a passport to the inner sanctum. Until 1949 he continued to serve in the CIC reserve as a captain. Within that organization there existed the baldly named CIC Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, IPU, that General Marshall had constituted in March 1942, and which survived until the late 1950s when its role, investigation of crashed UFOs in situ, was moved elsewhere. Perhaps it was here that Kissinger first became involved with covert UFO-related activity. He became a consultant to the Operations Research Office in 1951, a murky outfit under the control of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a consultant to the director of the Psychological Strategy Board in 1952, a covert arm of the National Security Council, and then to its successor organization, the Operations Coordinating Board until, it seems, 1961. The OCB was reportedly the highest policy-making board for implementing clandestine operations. Among numerous other moonlighting roles was a consultancy to the Weapons Systems Evaluation Group of the Joint Chiefs of Staff from 1959-1960. At the height of the Cold War, advanced alien technology doubtless qualified for description as a potential weapon system. All these assignments were concurrent with the Wang period. And later came Henry's career pinnacle, service as National Security Advisor from 1969 to 1975 and as Secretary of State from 1973 to 1977, firstly under Richard Nixon and then Gerald Ford. In these roles he stamped his imprint on world affairs like few other diplomats of the 20th century. He became the modern era's most famed exponent of diplomatic realpolitik, the practice of international relations as a muscular, pragmatic exercise rather than one driven by ideals and courtly behavior. The shrewd balancing of interests and the hard-eyed use of available instruments of power, both open and hidden, to further America's national interest were hallmarks of his style. Kissinger had a mind with the bite of a leghill trap, but it also contained a scent of paranoia and a penumbra of Spengelerian gloom. He had no qualms about reaching out and pulling secret levers when the mental clouds gathered. In 1969, when he was National Security Advisor, Kissinger began a creeping barrage of wiretaps on his own staff and others who raised his suspicions. The net reached out to include newsmen, and Defense Department and State Department targets. Kissinger pored over the juicy verbatim transcripts, provided by the FBI, looking for leaks, disloyalty and useful gossip. In 1973, when the eavesdropping was exposed by the press, he moved the blame sideways. An embarrassed Nixon, who had known of the wiretaps, grumbled to an aide, "They never helped us. Just gobs and gobs of material. Gossip and bullshitting." Kissinger spent a hell of a lot of time on these things, he told another interviewer. New York Times columnist, William Sapphire, one of the wiretap targets, came out of the experience a wiser man. A deeper understanding had come to him, he observed. When one is lied to by men who are convinced that consistent lying can be the right thing for the country. 2 years later, Sapphire's paper reported a Kissinger quip. "The illegal we do immediately. The unconstitutional takes a little longer." Does this sound like someone who could participate in history's most stifling and scary cover-up? Was there an eminence grise lurking in the wings from administration to administration, recycling the same old spooky stuff to timid new presidents-elect? Still, we must not let Henry become the lightning rod for all of our frustrations merely because his is the only name to have been reliably implicated in recent times. There were doubtless other establishment Brahmins involved, Greycraft guardians of the secret knowledge dining at the Cosmos Club before their silky conclaves in the Oval Office. But of one thing we can be sure, Kissinger's appetite for the exercise of power and his popularity with successive presidents right into recent times makes him a good candidate for MJ-12's Cardinal Emeritus of the 20th century. Chapter 1: The Trail That Led to Snapshot, Gleason v. Goldwater, Which One Gets to See the Alien. Secrecy not only breeds corruption and criminality but also, on a lighter note, farce. Where the light of public scrutiny cannot shine lies an existential vaudeville waiting to happen, a place where separating the men from the munchkins may be hard to do and where the yellow brick road can lead to the silliest of destinations. Take, for example, the contrasting fortunes of two UFO buffs, sitcom comedian Jackie Gleason and politician Barry Goldwater. Both were keen to get to the bottom of the mystery and find out what lay behind the wall of secrecy that the US government had erected. You think that Goldwater, of all people, deserved to know the truth. He had served his country in the Second World War as a pilot, remaining in the Air Force Reserve for decades afterwards. He eventually retired with the rank of Major General, having flown 165 different types of aircraft. He was a five-term United States Senator from Arizona and the Republican Party's candidate for president in the 1964 election. Goldwater, who died in 1998, was an honorable man with a solid family life and a widely respected record of achievement and principled behavior on Capitol Hill. By any standard, Barry Morris Goldwater stood in the front rank of American citizenship and leadership in the 20th century. In the early 1960s, after he had served in the Senate for a decade, Goldwater telephoned his friend, General Curtis LeMay, Chief of Staff of the USAF, to ask a special favor. He sought access to the Blue Room at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which was reputed to house preserved alien bodies and other recovered extraterrestrial artifacts. In 1994, Goldwater reflected on his UFO beliefs and the LeMay phone call in an interview with Larry King that ran on CNN. "I think the government does know," he told King. "I can back that up. But I think that at Wright-Patterson Field, if you could get into certain places, you'd find out what the Air Force and the government does know about UFOs." Reportedly, a spaceship landed. It was all hushed up. "I called Curtis LeMay and I said, 'General, I know we have a room at Wright-Patterson where you put all this secret stuff. Could I go in there?' I've never heard him get mad, but he got madder than hell at me, cussed me out, and said, 'Don't ever ask me that question again.'" Clearly, Goldwater had not made it into the Blue Room at the time of the Larry King interview, when he was 85. This despite the fact that for the last 20 years of his time in the Senate, Goldwater had specialized in defense policy. By contrast, Jackie Gleason put in no public service apart from moonlighting as an official contact for the FBI Miami office. He was a hard-drinking bon vivant whose career as a comedian, actor and musician spanned 40 years. The long-running TV series that cemented his place in American popular culture was The Honeymooners, which ran through the 1950s and 1960s. In this, he portrayed a character called Ralph Cramden, whose brashness would serve as a template for many of Gleason's other television, film and stage roles. He spent the latter part of his life living in Florida, where he formed a close friendship with President Richard Nixon. The two played golf together and socialized when Nixon took breaks from the White House at his home at Key Biscayne. In February 1973, the president took his entourage to Florida. White House records show that he hung out with Gleason at the Inverness Golf and Country Club, where he had come to open a charity tournament run by the comedian. Gleason told others later that both he and Nixon shared a close interest in UFOs. Gleason's interest was more like an obsession. He had a vast library on the subject and had built a home in Peekskill, New York, where much of the furniture had been manufactured in circular shapes to mimic flying saucers, including the garage. At the golf tournament, Gleason and Nixon played a round together and the subject of UFOs came up again at about the 15th hole. A Gleason acquaintance, former USAF Airman Larry Warren, was told what happened some hours after drinks with Nixon concluded in the clubhouse. "Mark down the date February 19, 1973. As yet another day in the career of Richard Mullis Nixon, which demonstrated his unique ability to move from banality to burlesque with as much comedic ease as his portly golfing buddy." Around midnight, Gleason and his wife at the time, Beverly McKittrick, answered a ring on their doorbell. It was Nixon, He was all alone for a change. There were no Secret Service agents with him or anyone else, Gleason told Warren. Nixon invited Gleason to get into the car because he wanted to take him somewhere to show him something. Perhaps Nixon had seen his friend star in the musical, Take Me Along, in 1959. In any case, he had come to take Gleason along on the journey of a lifetime. The two sped off in Nixon's private car to Homestead Air Force Base, 25 miles away. This was where Air Force One always landed when it brought the president to Florida. I remember we got to the gate and this young MP came up to the car to look to see inside, and his jaw seemed to drop a foot when he saw who was behind the wheel. He just sort of pointed and we headed off. We drove to the very far end of the base in a segregated area, finally stopping near a well-guarded building. The security police saw us coming and just sort of moved back as we passed them and entered the structure. Inside, Nixon showed Gleason the wreckage from a flying saucer enclosed in several large cases. Next, we went into an inner chamber and there were six or eight of what looked like glass-topped Coke freezers, recounted Gleason. Inside these were the mangled remains of small aliens, of the gray type. When Nixon dropped his friend home later, McKittrick found her husband badly shaken, she later revealed to friends. Gleason told Warren that for 3 weeks after the visit to Homestead he had trouble sleeping. This is the tawdry vaudeville waiting to happen inside the Chamber of Secrets, a place where a decent U.S. senator cannot make it to first base in the quest for the truth, while a five-pack-a-day comedian with a Rob Roy cocktail in his hand schmoozes his way to a home run. Those who are historically minded will be hoping that somewhere in the American bureaucracy there are researchers who have been tasked with the writing of the 20th century's hidden history. Perhaps a team of Daniel Ellsbergs with Let Me Pass red cards in their hatbands combing the classified filing cabinets, doing the oral interviewing, brainstorming, mind mapping, and distilling it all into incisive prose for archivists of the 21st, 22nd and 23rd centuries. But it's doubtful. The unadmitted will all too easily become the unrecorded. In the 2,500 years of recorded history since Herodotus picked up his quill and began scratching away at his history of the Greco-Persian Wars, this blank space in humanity's narrative is likely to become the greatest tragedy of historiography that will ever occur. The gravitational pull of this black hole in mankind's story has already seen thousands of riveting accounts sucked into the grave untold, with no diary entries left for a nosy posterity. Oaths of secrecy and fear of reprisal have brought about a genocide of primary sources. And who knows how many seminal documents have been gutted. Ultra Vires episodes passed through the shredder with a nervous look over the shoulder. There's a good precedent for a secret. Internal. History on a touchy matter carried out for high-minded historical purposes, the Pentagon Papers, which a small task force in the Defense Department completed in mid-1969 after a concentrated 18-month effort. This study of the faulty decision-making that led to America's involvement in Vietnam consisted of 47 volumes, about 7,000 pages in total, including 3,000 pages of narrative and some 4,000 pages of appendices. It was classified top secret and only 15 copies were made, one of which was leaked to the New York Times and other newspapers in 1971. The Pentagon Papers is a good template that needs to be followed for the UFO cover-up, right down to the denouement in the World Press. The right man to do the stylish overview would doubtless be Henry Kissinger himself, a key player and a sharp thinker. His Harvard doctoral thesis, books and articles demonstrate a voluminous mind with a philosophical depth and pitch-perfect feel for power and its chords that make for pleasurable reading. What we would give for a tell-all tale from the Twilight Zone, complete with trademark Rococo flourishes and nimble epigrams. Let us hope that in addition to his three volumes of autobiography, the man has had the good sense to pen a magisterial account of the untold story. Regardless of who writes this magnum opus, let us hope that it answers the following questions: when the strategic advantage of beating the Russians to alien-derived technology faded after the Cold War, why wasn't the whole thing disclosed? Was an agreement concluded with the Greys that traded off their technology for a green light on covert operations in the American hinterland? If so, What was the constitutional basis for this arrangement? With the molestations largely confined to the mainland USA, did the deal with the Greys change from favorable to Faustian? Did the enticement of novel new technology result in a lopsided dialogue with interlopers whose physiology, culture and intentions were unprofitable to planetary interests? Why weren't favorable protective agreements put in place with contactee-type visitors whose cultural compatibility and benevolent communications were more attuned to Earth's interests? Is the conduct of concealed diplomacy more likely to lead to positive outcomes than arrangements subject to legislative and public scrutiny? If so, what is the historical evidence to support this contention? With disclosure so long delayed, does its execution become increasingly impractical the more extensive and intensive the alien interaction and technological exploitation become? In other words, is the story now so big that its disclosure is unmanageable? Heads in the sand with the nuts and bolts evidence squirreled away behind barbed wire, millions of people still saw through the cover-up. Opinion polls confirmed that a big slice of the American public did not believe their government. The circumstantial evidence and hearsay reports were too convincing. Besides, thousands had seen their own UFOs, so they knew that the disclaimers could be discarded. What protected the conspirators from overthrow was not just their concealment of the evidence but the timidity of the scientific community and its reluctance to question the 20th century's hot new paradigm, the theory of relativity. Einsteinian physics was still oven fresh when the modern flying saucer era began, and no one had an alternative recipe that could explain how the aliens got here. Therefore they weren't here. Newtonian physics had lasted for more than 230 years before Einstein's general theory displaced it. After Newton, science had had time to adapt and thrive, to coalesce harmoniously around a new framework. Orderly structures of learning and career progression had been put in place. An even longer era of tranquility, nearly 2,000 years, had occurred between Aristotle's doctrines and Sir Isaac Sanus Mirabilis in 1666. Scientific historian and philosopher Thomas Kuhn has unwittingly provided a framework for understanding the UFO dilemma in his groundbreaking work, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, published in 1962. This book had sold more than 1 million copies in 16 languages and offers a made-to-measure doubt ensemble for the problem. Normal science will generally sideline, counter instance, or anomaly because of its disruptive effect on the profession, he wrote. Research is not about discovering the unknown, but rather a strenuous and devoted attempt to force nature into conceptual boxes supplied by professional education. Dominating the scientist's response is the educational initiation that prepares and licenses the student for professional practice. Because of this inbuilt inertia, science is not a steady, cumulative acquisition of knowledge but a series of peaceful interludes punctuated by intellectually violent revolutions when a new scientific paradigm triumphs. Einstein's theory of special relativity put in place creation's top speed, the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, which no physical object could surpass. Moreover, as it approached this speed, an object's mass would balloon out towards infinity. His equations showed. Therefore, space was virtually unbridgeable. With our nearby planetary neighbors' barren wastelands, extraterrestrial explorers would have to travel years to reach Earth. Proxima Centauri, the nearest star to the Sun, was 4.5 light-years away. ETs would have to travel for tens, hundreds, thousands of years to take a Hawaiian vacation. Without reliance on exotic articulations like multiple dimensions, galactic wormholes and the like, interstellar space travel was inconceivable. Sadly for Albert and the pulpiteers of physics, a paradigm-shattering anomaly arrived 33 years after Einstein first promulgated his celestial speed limit. A manned UFO crashed to Earth near Cape Girardeau, Missouri, in 1941. Its quick concealment, and that of subsequent crashes, was the savior of many sleepless nights in the halls of learning. Normal science could proceed happily while abnormal science was delegated to the Erequangs of the world. The challenge of nutting out a new theory to explain propulsion systems that could traverse interstellar space was hereafter to be done in private. But Thomas Kuhn's lethal counter instances were still out there and still looking ugly. Reports of close encounters, pilot sightings, radar confirmations, multiple witness events, photographs. Kuhn said that all crisis was resolved in one of three ways: normal measures that got the profession off the hook, Venus, meteors, swamp gas, bogus camera work, alcoholic overindulgence. For the tougher cases equals label and leave, more research needed into atmospheric plasma effects, cloud physics not fully understood, etc., or, more disastrously, paradigm war breaks out, no, we're not going there, we've only just got here. Joe Bloss could see that flying saucers were the real deal, it was just common sense, but Professor Bloss tied himself in knots. The profession's prestigious journal, Science, published a Circle the Wagons article in September 1967 entitled "The Physics and Metaphysics of Unidentified Flying Objects." Reported UFOs cannot be under extraterrestrial control if the laws of physics are valid. Valiant wagon train captain was William Markowitz, professor of physics at Marquette University, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. In 5.5 pages of tightly argued orthodoxy, Markowitz loosed off round after round into the tumbleweed of ufology. A clever dime in the air shot proved that there never had been any high-quality UFO sightings at all. At the end of the fusillade, science's holy writ stood unvanquished. UFOs are not under extraterrestrial control, he concluded, and the laws of physics do not need revision to accommodate UFO sightings. Phew. The paradigm stood intact. The arguments presented by Markowitz were indisputable within the context of known physics, textbook stuff that would confirm tenure at any self-respecting university. But then the good professor made his only serious misstep. He strayed into matters of strategy and politics, for which Einstein had offered no guidance. In regard to secrecy, he concluded, blowing smoke out of the still hot barrels. The charge that the U.S. Air Force is withholding information that UFOs are extraterrestrial is absurd. He squinted towards the article's sunset. The prestige of announcing the existence of extraterrestrial beings would be so great that no scientist, journalist, politician, or government, whether of the United States, England, France, the USSR, or China, would hesitate for a moment to release the news. It could not be kept a secret. Twirl of pistols and then back into the holster. Lest anyone think our erstwhile science contributor has been satirized here, spare a thought for the thousands of UFO witnesses and believers who have been ribbed and ridiculed over the decades. It takes courage to question orthodoxy, not defend it. The Condon Committee tragedy. The final nail in the coffin of serious scientific interest in UFOs was the University of Colorado study into UFOs, which ran from 1967-1968. The negative conclusions that this investigation reached made it well nigh impossible for scientists to obtain funding or approval for serious work in the field for the next 40 years. It was like the Vatican findings against Galileo in 1633, which shut down serious scientific discussion of heliocentrism for generations. The Church used capital punishment to enforce obedience to the required canon. American science enforced obedience with the tacit threat of professional ruin. Here and there a courageous individual bucked the trend, but generally the subject became a no-go zone for the rest of the 20th century and beyond. Serious work in the field was devolved to the layman, where it had sat comfortably in any case since 1947. Public UFO studies would be the first instance in the modern era where the bulk of the cutting-edge scientific work, observation and data recording, was carried out outside the profession. The Colorado study was funded by the U.S. Air Force as a reluctant response to heavy congressional pressure by, among others, Representative, and later President, Gerald Ford, of Michigan. Michigan had been the subject of a UFO flap which started in 1964 and continued into 1966, attracting headlines all round the world because of numerous close encounter sightings of clearly mechanical objects by scores of reliable witnesses, including 12 law enforcement officers. To quell public concern not so much at the sightings themselves but at the ludicrous and facile explanations that were offered by the Air Force, a government-sponsored university study was announced in mid-1966. The Air Force sounded out a number of universities but had difficulty finding a taker for the contract. It has always been assumed that this was because of the leprous odor that clung to the subject of flying saucers, but we may have been doing academia a disservice. Their reluctance may have been due to a sense of honor rather than disdain. 22 years after the USAF hunt for a contractor, came a reliable report that a confidential condition of the UFO study contract was that the conclusions to be reached had to be negative. In April 1988, author Whitley Strieber spoke before an audience at the University of Colorado. He was introduced by Dr. Walter Orr Roberts, President Emeritus of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Roberts, 73 years old at the time, had founded the richly funded National Center for Atmospheric Research, NCAR, in Boulder, Colorado, in 1960, which was an arm's-length affiliate of the university. He was one of the first scientists to warn that technology was changing Earth's climate. It is a matter of public record that in 1966 NCAR had been approached by the Air Force to carry out the UFO study after Harvard, MIT, the University of North Carolina and the University of California had turned the job down. Strieber found his venerable master of ceremonies at the Colorado gathering to be an open-minded and very fair man. He asked him why he had refused the Air Force request in 1966. Roberts responded that he had done it because he was told at the outset that the project was intended to draw the conclusion that there is nothing in the UFO controversy, and he did not feel comfortable with the fact that public claims were being made that the study was impartial. A few weeks after Roberts turned the Air Force down, citing pressure of other commitments, they found a willing taker in the physics department at Colorado University. Professor Dr. Edward Eukenden agreed to take the job on. He would be the project director and chief scientist. Eukenden was a nuclear physicist with a distinguished track record in research, invention and government service. He had participated in the wartime Manhattan Project and served a six-year stint as director of the National Bureau of Standards from 1945-1951. There is a 50 hours 50 minutes chance that Eukenden was party to the hidden world of crashed UFOs and the government reverse engineering program. He was appointed to the board of the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, NECA, the predecessor of NASA, in 1946, and resigned when he departed the Bureau of Standards. We know from an authentic-looking, majestic document leaked in 1996 that NECA had been one of the agencies enlisted to help in the assessment of recovered debris from the Roswell UFO crash in July 1947. Would the NECA board have been informed of staff involvement in this peculiar business? Probably. The NECA chairman was Dr. Jerome Hunsaker, of MIT, who was present 8 months after Roswell at the recovery of the crash disk near Aztec, New Mexico. People all around Eukenden were involved in this thing. Further tentative confirmation that he was part of the in crowd surfaced in February 1991. California researcher Tim Cooper interviewed a retired Air Force colonel who was in a key position to know the secret UFO developments in the post-war period. The colonel spoke convincingly about a wide spectrum of the secret activity that went on, including the technical exploitation of the recovered disks in the early days. Cooper asked him who was in charge of the scientific research. The reply: Von Braun, Eukenden, Oppenheimer and Teller. There is a point at which cynical behavior and deceit reach such profound depths that, for the victims reviewing it in retrospect, the whole thing causes sadness and even physical distress. This nadir in the UFO timeline was probably reached on October 7, 1966, when Secretary of the Air Force, Harold Brown, announced the appointment of Eukenden and his team to do the job. Brown announced that all UFO information in the possession of the Air Force will be made available to the team. By a conservative reckoning, the United States military had in its possession at that time 8-9 recovered alien craft and a large number of bodies. The combined efforts of U.S. researchers Ryan Woods and the late Leonard Stringfield suggest that the actual number of craft or crash wrecks could have surpassed 20. A sinister turn of events had also become apparent by the time the Condon Committee swung into action in 1967.